Good afternoon. I'd like to open the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water on this Tuesday, May 24, 2011. Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for watching at home. And
it's possible.
And I'd like to announce to everybody the way we're going to do things today. We would like to, in just a moment, open a work session on Senate Bill 626. We're hoping that Senator Morse joins us, but even if he doesn't, we're going to railroad it through. And then we're going to open an informational hearing on low-carbon fuel standards. At that point, we're going to give it about an hour. So we've got six invited guests, and so if you can sort of judge your timing accordingly, we'll appreciate it. We certainly want to have extra time if needed for questions from most of our panel up here. So with that, I will open I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 626. And Liz, if you'll just give our committee and those listening an overview of what this bill is about again, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 626 would direct the Department of Fish and Wildlife to study a program that would develop and protect Oregon's unique angling opportunities. The program would be entitled the Quality Fresh Waters Program. The bill would specify certain necessary requirements of the program and would require the Department of Fish and Wildlife to report to the interim legislative committees on or before November 1st, 2012 on the results of their study.
Thank you, Liz. And colleagues, you have a dash one in front of you. And Mr. Co-Chair, I would entertain a motion on those.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments dated 4/28/2011.
Thank you. Co-Chair Cannon moves the amendments, the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 626 dated 4/28/11. Is there any discussion on those amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think these, while they did not change the fiscal impact statement, and the bill will still need to go to Ways and Means, I do think that this amendment clarifies the senator's intent. Welcome, Senator. Maybe this is your cue. We're discussing the dash one amendments that you proposed, and I've moved those amendments. I'm suggesting that this may help in Ways and Means you to make the case that the bill should not come at the expense of other ongoing programs in ODFW. But I'll let you speak for yourself.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, good time. Colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, I represent the Albany-Corvallis area in the State Senate. We have a bill that is supported by the department, and there is theoretically a fiscal, but they have existing resources that they're already working in this direction. I believe the dash one amendments clarify that, and whatever pleasure it finds in Ways and Means, I think we just do the best we can. So I do appreciate your adopting the dash ones, and if we could move it down there, it's a bill that should emerge out of that process.
Thank you, Senator. And that's our intention. I want to make sure, are there any folks on the committee that have a comment on the dash ones or a comment or question to our friend Senator Morse? Seeing none, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll on the dash ones, please.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Mintz?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Gilley? Aye. The dash ones are adopted. And Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 626 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Cannon has moved Senate Bill 626 as amended to the committee. Where are we? To the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Now, is there any discussion on the amended bill? Seeing none, I'll again ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Thompson? Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Council Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gillis?
Aye. And the motion carries, and I wish we could assign a carrier, but we got one more stop, Senator Morse.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for your affirmation.
You bet. Thanks for coming. With that, I will close the public work session. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 626 and open the informational meeting on low-carbon fuel standards. We're going to have two panels, and I'd like to ask the first panel to come forward, Bob Russell, Dr. Randall Pozendina, and Marcy Putnam. Please come forward. And Bob, if you'll get us started, identify, and we'll begin the discussion.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm going to be try to be very brief this afternoon because I'd like you to have the opportunity to have a conversation, particularly with Randy Pozendina, who, in my opinion, is one of the most renowned economists in the state of Oregon. I've worked with him for a number of years. I have a great deal of respect for him, and he's going to have a great deal to say about the low-carbon fuel standard and the economic or potential economic impacts on Oregon. And, of course, I'd also like to save some time for Marcy because she talks about something that's very near and dear to my heart, which is jobs. 3 months ago, February 24th, we had a hearing in front of this same committee on the low-carbon fuel standard. Since that time, there has been one huge change impacting the trucking industry. On February 24th, the price of diesel fuel was $3 a gallon. Today, on May 24th, it's $4.06 a gallon, which is a fairly significant increase. That has been very difficult for us to deal with, as you might imagine. Fuel, for one of the first times in history, is now our single largest cost, and it has eclipsed our labor costs. As bad as that is, and it is catastrophic, crisis proportions kind of thing to us, it's not as bad as what we think the low-carbon fuel standard could do to us if it goes into effect. And let me explain sort of to you why. I worked all during the interim with DEQ on the task force that went over the low-carbon fuel standard, and I learned a great deal. In the end, DEQ produced an economic impact, and what you've got attached to my testimony is a two-page fact sheet that DEQ put together. Basically, DEQ's position is that the low-carbon fuel standard will produce up to 29,290 jobs and as much as $1.6 billion in economic benefit to the state of Oregon. But when they did that, they did a number of scenarios that had different assumptions. If you look at the second page, and you've got scenarios A through H. Scenario A through G, all of those, assume that a significant amount of the new fuels required to meet the low-carbon fuel standard will actually be produced in Oregon. From our perspective, that's an issue. Today, all of our petroleum fuels, or the vast majority of them, come from refineries in Washington State. Our biofuels, both ethanol and the most of the biodiesel, come from the Midwest. We have very little production. We have some biodiesel production in Oregon. There were a couple of ethanol plants, and I believe one of them is actually back up and running a little bit, but they actually went into bankruptcy. So from our perspective, we think that these fuels are going to continue to be produced out of state. cellulosic is sort of the next big thing that everybody keeps talking about. That's going to be the answer to all of these problems and going to give us the ability to produce reasonably cost fuels. And that with all of our forests and all that stuff, it'll be done here. I think most people today believe that that's not true, that they believe that it's going to happen in the Southeast and the Midwest, that even the cellulosic industry is not going to settle in Oregon. So if you believe, as we do, that we're going to continue to be an importer of fuels instead of a producer of fuels, then scenario H is the one that reflects, based on DEQ's analysis, what will happen going forward. That scenario assumes that, and basically it shows that there will be no economic benefit to the state of Oregon. That scenario, however, assumes that there will not be an increased cost of fuel. And I said earlier that I thought $4 a gallon diesel was bad, but the LCFS could be worse for us. And the reason I say that is because I believe the LCFS will cause fuel prices to go up. And it's the incremental difference that is the issue to us. Everybody in this country, $4.06 is the average for diesel. So the trucking companies in Oregon, the ones in California, the ones in Alabama are all paying around the same amount. So it's not impacting the competitiveness within the trucking industry. If Oregon's fuel is more expensive than the national average, which we believe the LCFS will do, then it will put us at a very competitive disadvantage. Right now, as you know, California is the only state that is headed down the path of an LCFS. And an example that I used last time I was here is I have members that live in Vancouver or have their trucking companies in Vancouver, Washington, that serve the Port of Portland and haul containers. I have them that live in Portland and serve the Port of Portland and haul containers. If the ones in Vancouver can get cheaper fuel, then the ones in Portland are either going to go out of business or they're going to move to Vancouver. I mean, it's as simple as that. And that is our huge concern with the low-carbon fuel standard, is that the price of fuel, the differential between what we would have to pay in Oregon and what we would pay in other states is going to be different. And that's going to put us at a competitive disadvantage. And for some of my members, it's going to literally put them out of business because, as you know, a truck can fill up here and drive to Chicago before they have to fill up again. So what's going to happen is people are going to come in, drop their shipments with full tanks, and they're going to pick up shipments here and take them out. And we're not going to be able to compete with that. So that's why we're so concerned about the low-carbon fuel standard, is that differential in the price. And so all of this is about economics from our perspective, and understandably so. Fuel is the lifeline of our industry. Last time I was here, I also pointed out to you that it's not that we don't want to address this issue. We very much think that carbon and global warming is a viable issue and that we need to do our part to address it. There are some significant initiatives going on the part of the federal government. The federal government has a renewable fuel standard. They are requiring the fuels industry to produce biofuels that don't have carbon. And they're required to do that nationwide. When they do that, it doesn't affect the competitiveness of Oregon's trucking industry with others because everybody's treated the same. And the federal government has also increased the CAFE standards, or the miles per gallon that automobiles are supposed to achieve. And President Obama earlier this year issued an executive order directing EPA to do the same thing for heavy trucks, which we think is great. We would love to reduce our fuel consumption and thereby reduce our carbon footprint. So it's not like we're not doing anything. it's our concern is that Oregon, going it alone, essentially, is going to have a devastating impact on certainly the trucking industry, which is a major user of fuels, and ultimately, I believe, the economy of the state of Oregon. Last time I was here, I asked you to suspend the low-carbon fuel standard until we knew more. I would sort of renew that request to you, although and just before the hearing, I was having a conversation with DEQ's director, Dick Peterson, and he said that based on a number of things, they are thinking about actually delaying implementation of that. So that concludes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions now or after we finish with the panel, however you choose.
Thank you, Bob, and I think we'll hold the questions, but I am interested in sort of exploring the conversation you had, and I note that our director of the DEQ is in the room. So we'll move on to the next person, but just by way of information for the committee, one of our invited testifiers couldn't make it, and we have we've got a great replacement in Michael Eaves, and I believe you're on the phone listening. Is that correct, Mr. Eaves?
Yes, it is. I'm here.
Hang with us here. You'll be on the second panel, but I wanted everybody to know who was on the telephone.
Thank you.
So with that, we can move ahead with either one.
Okay. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gillum, Co-Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcy Putman. I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 125, representing approximately 3,600 members who work in the Pacific Northwest utility industry. Some of you might question why this issue is so important to us, and it's sort of a two-parter. One, as individuals, our members live and work all over the place. A lot of them live in very rural areas, and they drive far places, and they live in those areas because they own farms, they own ranches, they do things that require them to live not in the metropolitan area. But more importantly, on behalf of our employers, they're scared. They're scared that when an employer, you know, I can look at my Dodge diesel pickup truck and it costs me, you know, almost $100 to fill it up. I have two of them at my house. But what does that mean for a fleet owner? What does that mean for the utilities where these folks work? As our members are going through negotiations and employers, our utilities are trying to figure out how to cut costs, these are significant costs that they don't have much choice with. You don't get to wiggle and barter your way through fuel prices. I, on behalf of the local, participated in the Low Carbon Fuel Advisory Committee along with Bob and others, and I learned a lot. And what I learned is no one has any ill intentions. Everyone recognizes the importance to the environment, but we're asking time out. Let's get our economy stabilized and figure out how we're going to make this work. Oregonians do not need higher fuel costs. They don't need more lost jobs and the associated expenses of voluntary regulation. Our local questions the timing of implementing a low-carbon fuel standard without a detectable impact to global warming. California, we heard about it frequently during the advisory committee, more than I care to know, we heard. And I question how we jump ahead with something. You know, do we not have the ability to say, let's wait and see? We know our friends to the north in Washington, they took that time out. They said, we've got some issues we need to take care of before we do that. I don't believe that delay diminishes Oregon's commitment to the environment. I don't think it diminishes our desire to continue being innovative. I think it's prudent and responsible. Early this year, I heard Commissioner John Norris of the Federal Energy Electric Commission say, don't build just to create jobs because it can lead to inefficiency. There will be jobs created by the result. Now, he was talking about my world, transmission poles and wires and towers, but I think it's applicable here. We heard a lot about the electric vehicles and how, you know, this is going to be the next best thing for Oregon. That's fine, but you all probably saw the same article I did a week or so ago in the Oregonian. The infrastructure's not there. We're not ready. We don't have the ability to keep jumping in and hoping these things are going to fall into place. We thank you as legislators for your commitment. We thank the DEQ for its innovativeness and passion and commitment. And Oregon's benefited from it. Cities, Ben, Eugene, of course, Portland, Corvallis, there's been recognition for the things that have been accomplished, and we're proud of that and we're pleased with it, but there's been a catch because now people, non-Oregonians, non-Oregon-based companies come in, they take advantage of the tax exemptions, they take advantage of the low-cost loans, and they get the benefits from it, but then they leave. And what do we get for Oregon? What do the Oregonians get? What happens once the structures are built and the people are gone? Others are going to testify about new jobs being created. Will these jobs support families? Are they going to be permanent jobs that stay after the tax incentives are gone and the structures built? With more regulatory requirements and reporting combined with increased costs of fuels, including electricity, employers, especially small businesses, they're going to have to trim costs. Oregon's not moving forward if we eliminate those jobs and replace them with low-paying positions that prevent workers from supporting their families. Local 125 is not opposed to green energy. We simply ask that we consider the reality, including costs, job loss, and lack of infrastructure. In summary, I remind you that our focus, we're not about poles and wires, we're about people. It's not about solar installations or wind farms, it's about people. We request that you not implement a low-carbon fuel standard at this time. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll move on to, I'm having trouble with your name, and I'm sorry. It's Dr. Pozdina, correct?
That's right. Thank
Please.
You. That's very close. It's a Bohemian close. Name, and I don't even pronounce it correctly.
So. I feel better.
Thank you, Co-Chair, Co-Chairs Cannon and Gilliam and the committee. Thank you for having me here. I did bring a slideshow, and I'm not sure whether the lighting is sufficiently romantic for you to be able to see the details on the slide, but I'm going to walk through this very quickly since you have given us a short agenda. I just wanted to first tee it up. I'm a PhD economist. I've been practicing for 35 years, Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, a professor, Stanford Research Institute. And I'm representing today a firm that I own called Quanticon, which is a quantitative economics and finance consultancy. What I have done, and I just have to grab the computer here so I can control it, put together a slideshow here to emphasize a couple of points that economists would make about the proposed low-carbon fuel standard. The first is that we, as economists, we think you're being asked to, frankly, believe the implausible, namely that an administrative intervention into the mix of fuels that power the Oregon economy is somehow going to create more jobs and income than it kills, and that these administrative rules and procedures are going to be smarter than the market's own allocative forces. You're also being asked to believe that a group of other interventions will head off any possible adverse effects. Some people are calling those off-ramp policies. And also that the effects of the regulations will be to reduce fuel costs. The DEQ's fact sheets say it's going to be lower costs at the pump, and that it's the regulations that provide this powerful incentive to provide alternative fuels. But in order to have that incentive, actually prices have to rise. But you're being told prices are going to fall. So there's just that fundamental inconsistency. Perhaps most importantly of all is that you're being told that the anticipated benefits of low-carbon fuel will transpire and that they will exceed the economic losses that the LCFS in other ways is going to create. So with that sort of verbose entree, let me just tell you what I'm going to talk about. First, I'm going to talk about what's wrong with the concept, just from an economist standpoint. And we're not brought in because we sing or tell jokes very well. We're just brought in to, frankly, to put people to sleep sometimes. And I'm going to tell you what's wrong with the DEQ-JFA economic impact calculations. And I'm not blaming my good friend Mike Lawrence at Jack Fawcett Associates, who's been a 20-year friend, but just the process by which those calculations were made. Why also I think the safety net features, the off-ramp features, are not, in fact, safe. What is actually likely to happen, and what should be done instead. I'll get through this pretty fast because I know you're on a tight schedule. So what's wrong with the concept? There's only one slide, but it's key. Economic theory actually does not support the use of quantitative regulation. It says by reaching into the economy and trying to make it behave differently, it's a little bit like taking a jackhammer to a watch. It's a complicated organism, the economy is. and quantitative regulations of things that are market traded, like ethanol and gasoline, are you can't do that regulation without causing some harm. It will not increase economic output, incomes, or jobs. On the contrary, theory is incredibly clear here that the distortions will actually have the reverse effect. And unfortunately, worse yet, the clumsiness of the regulation, I don't mean that the people are clumsy, their intentions are bad, or anything like that. It's just that there's such brute force, regulations can easily thwart the ultimate environmental aims that I think we all share. The inefficiency that results from all this raises the prices of the favored goods, in other words, the ones you want to be entering the market, absent costly subsidies. And if you do subsidize something that the market has rejected, that's risky, perhaps even foolhardy. Subsidies transfer wealth in an arbitrary fashion, and more importantly, it reduces resources for other uses. They don't come out of the blue. They come from someplace else, causing losses of jobs, income, and investment, and possibly, again, worsening emissions. There's not a free lunch here, as the late Milton Friedman said. There is really no free lunch. So now what's wrong with the computations? Again, not beating up on DEQ or JFA or my friend Mike Lawrence. But the DEQ fact sheets, having said that, I'm going to beat up on them, that there will be more jobs, 860 to almost 30,000, 29,000, depending upon the scenario, A through H. Higher income, 60 million to 2.6 billion. Lower fuel prices. I'm giving a quote here because this seems to be in denial about this. A low carbon fuel standard will result in lower costs at the pump to fuel users, leaving more funds available for other things, with savings estimated at $43 million to $1.6 billion. Now, these results seem to follow from using Jack Foss Associates using the REMI model, and it's a great model. It's incredibly complex. It's a great general tool, but it may not be as good as a tool built for the purpose at hand, which is this very narrow sort of target that you've got for your policy here, ethanol, the refining and retailing of this product. And there, as a result, you have to make a whole slew of assumptions and approximations to model this within REMI. REMI in general, though, by the way, doesn't look like the economy. There's no central bank. There's no interest rates. Government spending is driven by age and income. If you looked at it, you'd say this looks like a Swiss Army knife that was made in China and not by the Swiss. It's been criticized in the literature, in fact, for predicting that more government activity of no matter what type always creates, quote-unquote, more income. And that was a criticism of Professor Edwin Mills at Northwestern University. Other models, not surprisingly, yield findings opposite to that of JFA's use of REMI. Charles River Associates, a firm that's been in existence for 40 years or so in the Boston area, has its own MRN-REAM multi-regional, national model, national electricity energy model. That's what that abbreviation stands for. And also the National Bureau of Economic Research, the people that bring you business cycles. They don't bring them to you, but they tell you when they've begun and stopped, published an LCFS-specific study evaluating the policy in 2007 I'll talk about briefly. Now, there's a whole bunch of problematic assumptions. I said there were and this is just a partial list, but there's some optimism here in the input values, costs of the individual biofuels, the ability of the fuels to actually reduce emissions, the pace at which low-carbon fuels arrive in our economy, and then things that they've ignored or underestimated, the negative effect of higher fuel prices on vehicle miles of travel and fuel purchases. You've just heard testimony to the fact that it's a key input to vehicle miles traveled, and yet somehow higher fuel prices don't matter. Other interactions of the fuel market with the rest of the economy. It's not just trucks that are powered by number two diesel oil. It's also some home heating, electricity, and lots of other things. The cost of building the necessary biofuel infrastructure in Oregon is free in this model. There's no cost. No capital cost. The capital is going to come here voluntarily and build these things for free. There's no offsetting diversion of capital costs. So the loss elsewhere in the economy from diverting capital to Oregon to build this stuff is nowhere to be seen. Now, you can have battles of the model. There's a talk show where families are battling each other, and it's a little bit like that in economics. But let me just point out that the CRA model, which does sensitize itself to fix or sensitize itself to most of these problems, produces exactly the opposite result of the JFADEQ model, or REMU model, I should say. In particular, vehicle miles traveled, and I just pointed, these are negative signs here, so vehicle miles traveled will fall under either the pessimistic or the optimistic scenario compared to no LCFS. Earnings by labor will fall. Gross state product will fall. So the jobs and the incomes, you've been told, won't materialize. Now, it's a battle of the models, but I just want to point out, this is the one that's consistent with economics, with economic theory. Fuel costs will rise from 20-plus percent to perhaps as high as 100%. That's a doubling. And the cost of the LCFS per household in that in a household's lost income will be somewhere between, I think this is around $260 or $280 to almost $1,300 per household just in that 1 year, 2022. Gets there slowly, but it gets there in 2022. Now, on top of these, this battle of the models, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which again is entrusted with the task of deciding when we've had business cycles and what's caused them and when they've started and when they've ended, and it concluded the following. These are approximate quotes, which is why I have them in italics, that LCFS standards have a large cost in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. That's economic babble, but it basically means that it's going to make the economy stumble along, function less well, produce less jobs, produce less income, produce less output, and that a policy that does it the way that's proposed here of mandating a 10% content of fuel reduction, carbon content reduction, is a good policy only under the most unrealistic conditions or assumptions. In fact, an LCFS can actually raise carbon emissions and likely, almost certainly, but they say likely will increase fuel prices. Now let's get really to where the carbon meets the economy, as it were. Reducing the carbon content by 10% through an LCFS will cost about $300 to $2,200 annually per ton of CO2 actually reduced. So if it does reduce, it's going to cost a lot per ton reduced. But if you look at climate studies, and there was a review done by Toll of 103 of them, that the value of reducing CO2 in terms of climate damage and economic damage is only $50 per ton. So you're going to spend $300 to $2,200 per ton to abate something that's worth $50 a ton. Say you don't believe that. Make it $100 a ton. Make it $200 a ton. Would you do that? The bottom line is the economic costs of the LCFS are greater than the economic benefit by a factor of 6 to 40 times. If I offered that to you as an investment advisor, I'd be in a striped suit rather than this romantic blue color that I've got on today. The safety net is not safe. By the safety net, now I mean exemptions of some users and the delay or suspension of LCFS policy if it causes fuel prices to rise. And there's been a shorthand notion of that's called the off-ramp notion. A couple of inconsistencies. If prices and costs are going to be lower, why do we need exemptions at all? I think there's disbelief. That's what I think. I think people realize that this is a shot in the dark. The investments and adjustments required to use alternative fuels can't be costlessly stopped or reversed. So you're asking an industry to say, wait for the off-ramp, spend all the money to get to it, and then see if it's open or closed. That's costly. And it's not. And the industry's reaction to that is going to be basically, again, to hit incomes, jobs, and output. And then the question that I raised, I didn't see it in any of the talking points, is who decides if a price rise was caused by the LCFS? I put a graph here of what's happened to the price of ethanol just since in the last 6 months. I drew this graph off the internet on May 13th. That's almost a factor of two change just in 6 months. Now, who is going to tell me that when something's moving, bouncing around like that, that they can attribute the LCFS to it or not. And my prediction is the off-ramp is just going to be closed. It's always going to be not the LCFS. It's going to be speculators or some other bugaboo, boogeyman that's going to be blamed. What is actually like to happen? First of all, what we know already is that at the national level, we've been subsidizing biofuels at the highest rate of any of the transportation-related fuels. And so we've already probably had large economic losses. We're wondering why the heck we can't get out of this recession, why the recovery is so slow. I'm not blaming the national policy there, but it could be. And then, you know, you have folks at the UN saying that as a result of our grain ethanol subsidies, we impoverished in 2008 100 million people elsewhere in the world. That's something I occasionally care about. Other countries have already, the key thing is that we've got other countries that we can look at who have tried regulatory inventions, trying to fiddle with prices, fiddle with quantities, or force technology. What's the consequences? No measurable effect on carbon emissions. Green jobs creation is proved to be just a hoax. There's been a loss of jobs. Energy prices have risen, not fallen. And the subsidies keep growing, something we barely can afford. So here's federal subsidies by energy sector, just to give you facts on my points. Renewables got the largest, various other end uses, you can see them there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. But here are the federal non-electricity subsidies by fuel per million BTU in 2007. This is from USDOE, although the computations are made by Michaels and Murphy. Ethanol and biofuels is already on a BTU basis, which is the amount of energy a fuel contains, by far the largest, followed by solar, which we can't seem to get enough of, followed by refined coal, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when I said no measurable effect on carbon, this is from the European Business Review. I have a quote from Angela Merkel that I couldn't fit onto this slide, too, but basically said the EU policy has produced no discernible real-world evidence of this kind of a double negative sense, but accelerating the natural rate of decarbonation in Europe. So in other words, there's been no acceleration of the trend toward lower carbon. And in fact, their rate has been no faster, their rate of getting things better has been no faster than that of the U.S., which never was party to the protocol they've been applying. And then Michael Frondell, a German critic of Germany, which has been perhaps second only to us and third to Spain, gung-ho in this area, says, in the end, cheaper alternative abatement options are not realized that would have been pursued in the counterfactual situation had they not passed their EEG, that's the German abbreviation of what's called the Renewable Energy Sources Act. So, again, it's one of these things that you play with a watch with a jackhammer at your peril. And then some statistics here. Spain, the university folks said that for each green job created, 5.2 to 8.99 regular jobs were destroyed. And it diverted a bunch of capital. I've already mentioned that. In Germany, the long-term employment effects of the promotion are negative. And then some American professors describing why. Basic point being you can't, Congress or United States or even our legislature cannot order economic growth. Now, empirically, there's just some slides here. Just want you to look at the slopes of things. You'll be provided with a copy of this, and you'll have all the background you want. You heard that energy prices are going to fall if you get into renewables because, gosh, you know, they do all these things so wonderfully. Here's Danish electricity prices. Here's German electricity prices. You can look at those trends. And the renewables continue high, even though this, I think, is the Germans here. Even though they've slowed their spending on wind, because turns out they only get wind 17% of the year, and therefore power only 17% of the year, the total spending on subsidies continues to skyrocket. This is a big rate of growth. This is just in 7 years that you're observing here, and this is what's been happening to the percentage of the subsidies. It's been going to biomass increasingly and to solar cell increasingly, and the German solar cell experiment paying people 50 cents a kilowatt hour to save a kilowatt hour that they can produce for two and a half cents is the kind of issue that you're facing here. So when you boil it down to a cost per job in Spain, 0.7 to 1.1 million euros per job. I don't know what the euro exchange rate is today, but that's million plus per job. In Germany, 257,000 a job. All the citations are at the bottom of my slides. What to do instead? Here's some nice slopes. BTU per dollar GDP going down. Gallons of fuel used per vehicle mile traveled going down. Energy used in ammonia production going down. What's wrong with these charts? There's no regulation in them. This is producers and consumers and households don't wake up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'll roll a barrel of oil into the backyard and drain it onto the grass. You don't buy energy without having some purpose for it, and you're very sensitive to the price. And so historically, I think this one's the most impressive. It's down to almost a theoretical minimum price of producing ammonia. I know that's over 80 years, but there's still a very rapid rate of decline. And these two have approximately the same date range, 1950, 2008, 49, 2008. So it is possible for simply the tightness of supply of product and the technology that's not forced but that's brought along by common sense business decisions to give you what you want. Lower energy usage. If you lower energy uses of carbonaceous fuels, you're going to bring down carbon. So the market can save energy, the economy, and the climate. So I think that's there's just an ad about the author there. Forget that. But I just want to summarize. I just want to say that the bottom line is that there are going to be decreases in jobs, not increases. There's going to be decreases in income, not increases. There may well be increases in emissions instead of decreases. And moreover, if Oregon does it as Bob indicated a moment ago, if Oregon's the only one or significantly the only one that does it, it's going to be standing out like a sore thumb with a big disadvantage. Now, I think that's very important to Bob, and we can't have that kind of distortion. And I agree with Bob and the IBEW precisely on this issue. But my picture is bigger still. It says, don't pay a dollar to get a dime back. Just don't do it. Thanks very much. I appreciate your attention. We usually put folks to sleep, and you've been kind to stay mostly awake.
They're all with you. Thank you, Doctor. Representative Bailey, question?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think the difference between studies often lies in the assumptions that underlie any particular model that you use. I'm curious, on your slide, Mr. Pozzina, you had up there I believe it was 3 cents per BTU in subsidies going to petroleum. Is that correct?
That's directly from, that is directly, I'll get you there. Representative Billy, that was natural gas and petrol liquids, that's right, per million BTU, correct?
Per million
3 cents.
BTU. Mm-hmm. Well, do you happen to know the total amount of subsidy that goes to petroleum liquid fuels versus biofuels?
I think it was not in the previous slide. 2.1 billion versus renewables, 4.8. I don't have biofuels broken out.
Biofuels aren't broken out. Renewable.
Please.
I guess the point that I'm trying to drive at here is that I think part of the models, if you absent any sort of consideration of externalities, that assume a perfect market and assume that we are not subsidizing on the one hand and subsidizing on the other hand, and to say that decision hasn't already been made to tilt the scale on the petroleum side of the equation, I think is erroneous, and perhaps we're playing catch-up here. Do your models take into account the overall subsidy on petroleum and what we might get if we eliminated those subsidies?
The CRA model considers the subsidies, but let me make the more fundamental point. Does it? In economics, you don't get a right by adding two wrongs. let's say it's wrong to subsidize one of the other fuels, a non-renewable fuel. If you subsidize renewable fuel, what do you end up with? More total fuel consumption. And what's most fuel, even most renewables fuel, got in either content or manufacture of capital or the transmission method? Carbon. So yeah, if you want to heap another subsidy on top of another, do it. But what you're doing is you're stimulating the use of fuels of all kind. And fuels of all kind, the ones with any very intense energy content, except nuclear, contain carbon. Well, even nuclear, you have to pour a whole bunch of concrete to make a nuclear power plant. That concrete requires just a boatload of petroleum, as do the transmission wires and so forth. So unfortunately, Representative Billy, I agree that we're just surrounded by subsidies. But two subsidies don't make a correction. They make a further distortion.
Well, I'll look forward to our trip together to D.C. to advocate for ending our military intervention to protect oil fields. But the other part of the equation is around where these jobs are located. And I'm curious if you know how many refining jobs we have in the state of Oregon.
Well, essentially none, because we don't refine anything.
Paul?
One more follow-up, and I'll see if anybody else does. Go right ahead.
Okay. Do you happen to know how many jobs we've created through the biofuels industry here in Oregon?
I would guess that, if anything, we've lost jobs.
Net jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Final follow-up?
Sure.
I'll just make a comment, and I appreciate the chair's indulgence.
Absolutely.
I do, in my mind, enjoy the fact that when I go to fill up my diesel CRD, I'm paying about 50 cents less a gallon for biodiesel right now than the folks in line behind me who are filling up for petroleum diesel. I'm putting that money right back into the economy. So at some point, I'd love to find out how the models incorporate the price benefit that we're getting from biofuels.
I appreciate your comment, Representative Billy. I thought you were going to ask me when I would stop beating my wife in a minute, but that's
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about administrative intervention and the CAFE standards. So I think I read this morning or yesterday that the true reduction in fuel consumption will be driven by CAFE standards, which seems to be as about administrative as you get.
Yep.
So maybe you could just comment on whether those have worked, because I'm curious about this overall administrative approach, and that appears to at least have done something to reduce or suggest fuel conservation. But
no one disputes the fact that cars manufactured today are more fuel efficient than cars that I used to race around town when I was a kid. The question is, how much did it cost to get there, and how much relative to what we are now saving? And I can point you to, I don't have it referenced in my slideshow, point you to a computation that says the expense of that, again, far exceeds the gains. So it's called technology forcing, and technology is a very hard thing to force, as we've learned to our rue many, many times. You can pay a lot of money to the auto industry, and we're paying more to them still, to force higher fuel efficiency standards. And the CAFE standards primarily are focused on passenger vehicles and light trucks. But the question is, after you've spent that, and over the years you've lost the interest in the opportunities of investment that all those subsidies cost you, did you get bang for your buck relative to what you would have gotten if you just... Let me see if I can very quickly get to that graphic. Yeah. So, implicit, somewhat, Representative Benson, your comment is the notion that during this time period here, when the CAFE fuel standards were in place, that somehow there had not been a downward decline There's gallons per VMT before, but just post, except for the immediate post-war periods, we were all driving around cars. My father had a Henry J, which was a Kaiser-built tank, basically. It's been a downward slope continuously. And we probably have more to credit to the Japanese, whose own economy can't support big cars running around their skinny streets, than the CAFE standards. But cost-effectiveness is the name of the game. I don't dispute, sir, that we don't have more fuel efficient cars today. The question is, what did it cost us? And what's going to happen to the value of my car? There's a wealth impact too, sir, that I'd just like to articulate very briefly. If a very fuel efficient vehicle is produced, I've got, let's say I have a brand new car, it gets 30 miles to the gallon, but someone comes out with a 50 mile per gallon car, suddenly my car is going to be worth much, much less on the used car market, right? That's a wealth loss that's never accounted for in any of these computations and translations in favor of standards of this type.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor, I'm presuming, and perhaps incorrectly, one of the perversions of the market that you described and suggested that LCFS would actually work to raise carbon outputs, I believe. And is that driven largely by substitute fuels?
It needn't raise them, but the way it would raise them is by encouraging consumption. If all of the assumptions worked, you'd have lower cost fuel, which would lead to higher consumption of fuel, and it's going to be carbonaceous even if it's lower concentration of carbon. So that's the way that's one way that it can get up. The other is that you've taken capital, scarce capital, from other industries that are busily trying to limit their consumption of energy and their consumption of carbon, say an ammonia manufacturer, which they're pretty much done. They're at the theoretical minimum cost of energy per unit of production of ammonia. But there are others out there who want to refurbish their capital to take advantage of lower fuel bills. But their money's going to have been diverted to a biofuel plant I don't know where. So that's how it happens. And again, it's the Swiss watch analogy or the mechanical watch analogy. All the gears are so interconnected that if you try to twist one a little bit too hard, you can have an adverse effect on the timekeeping capability of the timepiece.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please, Mr. Witt.
Assuming on the basis of what Bob was telling us that we were facing a restricted market in terms of available biofuels and that would increase the cost. That's not the scenario that you're describing then.
I think it could very well be that cellulosic ethanol, if that's the salvation that we're going after, will be very costly. If you removed all the subsidies that would be needed to cause it to come about, the technology pushing subsidies and actions, it very well could be that it proves to be more costly than existing fuels.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just have a few questions.
That's okay, and thank you, Mr. Postina. I want to preface my comments by expressing appreciation. I think anything that adds to the consideration of the effects of the standard is very important, and I think you've done that. In that vein, I hope that you'll make available your findings. I did receive an abstract of them, but unlike the Fawcett study where I've got, 80 pages of assumptions and tables and analysis that I can read through. I don't have that with yours, so I hope that you'll make that available to members of the committee.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. I point out that I think the thumbnail way to understand your results is by taking the Jack Fawcett study and turning it upside down. All these graphs that were pointing up are now pointing down. It's very simple that way. So maybe I don't need the whole thing. I can just turn myself or turn these papers. A couple of questions. We know that the Fawcett study was funded through a federal grant to DEQ. How is your research funded?
I believe my client is the Western States Petroleum Association. I'm working through their council.
Okay, thank you. And how do your findings compare with the findings of other studies related to the economic impacts of low carbon fuel standard implementation on a state basis? We have the Jack Fawcett, but we have as well a USC study on the economic impact of Florida's Energy and Climate Action Plan. We have a Washington State Low Carbon Fuel Standard Analysis. We have Northeast State's Low Carbon Fuel Standard Analysis done by Washington Department of Ecology and the Clean Air Association of Northeast States. We have a CARB economic analysis done by researchers at CARB. There's a national analysis. How do your findings compare with those? You mentioned two studies or two groups that you sort of referred to, but I've listed five or six others. Yeah. How do your findings compare with those?
Well, I do cite, and you'll have those citations, others who have reached exactly the same conclusions. But I did cite three, actually, which was a National Bureau of Economic Research study, which was staffed by, ironically, two professors from California and one professor from North Carolina State University. And they're the ones that gave me those, or their research is what gave me their calculations of the very high cost of remediating carbon emissions. And so there are those studies. I think what I'm introducing that's new here is a link back to the concepts, because the battle of modelers, is a bit like Family Feud. The models are very complex. You yourself said there's page after page after page of assumptions in the Fawcett model, which is actually input to the REMI model. Those are why they're making those assumptions, and they have to be made. But is the real question is, what does theory in practical sense tell you? That you can fix the watch with a jackhammer, that you should use something that is designed to fix the watch. And I'm simply saying that the REMI model, which is a massive model, many equations, many parameters, many assumptions, and very many simplistic shortcuts that have to be taken for good reasons, data availability, et cetera, is probably not one that I would urge you to rely on. And that's why we fall back on theory, or in the case of the NBER, they're modeling of a completely different type of what LCFS does.
And Mr. Chair, I know we don't have a lot of time. I just want to ask a couple questions, since you raised assumptions. I just want to get a couple of things on the table. And again, if you are able to deliver your findings to the committee, that'll probably answer a lot of the questions that I have. But without the benefit of those, I want to get a couple of other things on the record. What do you assume that the cost of oil will be in 2022 when this standard comes into effect?
Let me clarify, Representative Cannon. I personally am making no assumptions. Okay. I'm reporting the contrasting findings of the JFA REMI model with the CRA MRN NEEM model and the NBER modeling. I myself have done research in this area, but not that's dispositive to this topic. Okay, I didn't study.
Surely the results here are dependent on certain assumptions about the price of oil versus the price of biofuels, and that is reflected, I think, in a lot of what you've described to us. So I'm trying to understand what you assumed about the price of oil in 2022, or what your models that you relied upon assume about the price of oil in 2022.
Yeah, and that's, again, that's something that I don't have it in front of me. It would be in the assumptions of the CRA or the JFA work.
Okay.
I'm just taking their assumptions on face value and saying,
okay,
I'm not here to poke at Mike Lawrence or anything else. Just saying.
We will distribute. If you'll get that to us, we'll make sure that our committee administrator distributes that to all members.
Okay, one final. And
please
again,
do,
I appreciate
you
your indulgence and the committee's
and
indulgence.
Right,
and how much low carbon fuel production capacity do these models assume the U.S. will have in 10 years or 15 years under these models? Are we talking about an assumption that it remains where it is today, which is relatively small, or are we assuming, do these models consider the possibility that we would have considerably more?
I think the CRA MRN NEEM model actually has a model that has within it the evolution of the necessary capital to produce biofuels. So it is actually predicting the rate at which it will accrete. In the REMI model, it has to come in as an assumption, and the assumption is that not only will it come in rapidly, but in 7 out of the 8 scenarios, it will be in Oregon.
Just to clarify, so what do these models predict about low carbon fuel capacity in the state.
Well, again, JFA REMI says it comes in, the capacity comes in very rapidly.
Right, I'm asking about your models.
My model is not being, my personal modeling is not being brought to bear here.
Okay. So the models that you've relied upon assume very quick expansion of low carbon fuel standard, low carbon fuel capacity in the state and nationally.
I think the REMI, I'm sorry, the JFA implementation of REMI has it occurring costlessly and quickly. The CRA model has it occurring at a slower rate with cost.
Okay.
And perhaps because of cost.
It's slower. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And thank you all for your testimony. Seeing no other questions. I'm going to call the other panel, and I'm going to start with you, Mr. Eaves, while Ian Hill and George Beard come forward. Just before you start, Mr. Eaves, I want to say I had one question that was prompted during this other panel, and I'm going to give our director the last word today, but I'm hoping you'll specifically address the idea of where the department is on our schedule, if there's any change or any insight to that. But I'll hold that for the last word. And Mr. Eaves, please go identify and please go right ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Michael Eaves. I'm the Vice President of Technology Advancement here at Clean Energy in California. One of our colleagues, Todd Campbell, has been intimately involved with your staff up there in helping develop the low carbon fuel standard. Clean Energy, and I participated and worked with Todd on a lot of some of the issues and everything that have come up over the debate on what that should look like. Clean Energy supports Oregon's low carbon fuel standard. I think it has an appropriate slow phase-in period. I think it gives fuel providers time to develop solutions and comply. I think discussions on mechanisms to sunset or repeal the standard are premature, and I encourage you to keep the regulation in place and keep the pressure on fuel providers to comply with Oregon's long-term vision of what it would like to achieve in terms of lower carbon and lower greenhouse gases. Clean Energy obviously supports natural gas as a low-carbon fuel. I heard a lot of discussion today on biofuels and why they may not be in the as robust a solution as maybe some people thought, but natural gas provides 20% reduction in greenhouse gases when used in heavy-duty vehicles, provides 30% reduction in greenhouse gases when used in light-duty vehicles, can provide more than 80% reduction when renewable natural gas from landfills, from wastewater treatment plants, from biodigesters are used instead of just the fossil fuel. Natural gas is a cost-effective, domestic, and plentiful resource in North America and in the United States. I was just online this morning and noted that the range of gasoline prices in Oregon for today were somewhere between $3.68 a gallon and $4.19 a gallon. Compressed natural gas in retail stations at the pumps in California is selling for $2.30 to $2.60 a gallon, sold in volumes to our fleet customers. Is probably a 10% discount to those prices. This morning's Oregon diesel prices are around $4.19 a gallon. CNG and LNG would run around $2.50 a gallon for a diesel equivalent gallon. more use of natural gas in the marketplace takes demand pressure off of gasoline and diesel. That's one of the things that we are promoting on a national level to offset imports of foreign oil and helping to reduce use of natural gas in that type of scenario helps to reduce, not raise, gasoline and diesel prices by offering a cost-effective alternative fuel in the market. And the target market for natural gas is really in goods movement and heavy-duty vehicles, but it also is applicable all the way down into consumer vehicles like my Honda Civic GX that I drive every day. The fuel price savings will result in low prices for the consumer goods, which are transported by, to the market by manufacturers. So a natural gas fuel market, even if it is confined to a heavy-duty market, which it doesn't necessarily have to be confined to that market, may not offer consumers lower prices at the pump if they're using gasoline or diesel, but would certainly provide lower-priced goods at the store shelves for them. Clean energy is looking hopefully this year to the passage of the Natural Gas Act in 2011. That's been on the books for nearly 3 years now. But the new bill, H.R. 1835 in Congress, has tremendous bipartisan support. It will offer incentives to purchase natural gas vehicles, and one can sit there and say that, well, that's providing a subsidy for the fuel. If I took those subsidies for vehicle purchases and converted those to dollar per gallon over the fuel displaced over the life of those vehicles, those federal incentives are going to offer what will cost about 18 to 30 cents per gallon of fuel used in those vehicles. As I mentioned before, it's especially attractive for heavy-duty vehicles. And Oregon is going to be one of the main beneficiaries because you've got Daimler, the headquarters for Daimler Trucks Freightliner in Portland, Oregon. The CEO of Daimler Trucks reported at a Long Beach conference, alternative fuel conference, a couple of weeks ago, that natural gas truck sales were beyond all their expectations, and they see a very, very robust market developing for those, and that means obviously more jobs for the state of Oregon. And jobs aren't limited to manufacturing the vehicles. Essentially, natural gas fuel, you have to put in a station and you have to spend capital to do that. And that provides, construction jobs and service and maintenance jobs, for that infrastructure. And those will be in Oregon, and those will stay in Oregon. I was remarking that some of the documentation that's out that on the safeguards that you've got, and I guess I'm impressed with the level that defines what kinds of safeguards that you could put in place and everything to kind of hedge your bet on the whether this standard performs as you would like it to or not. But one would think that looking at that there are only downside risks to mitigate and no upsides. I look at your economic impact analysis, and I know that that's been severely critiqued by the previous speaker. But I think that those benefits, I think, are, in terms of natural gas and everything, are real. I think fuel price savings, personal income increases, jobs. I think those can be a reality in the state of Oregon. And I think, as I mentioned before, provisions to sunset the bill or repeal the bill are really premature, because if you do that, there's no incentive for anybody to try to perform and to provide your benefits. And like I say, the most in the speakers that were preceded me, it seems like a lot of the discussion is about biofuels, but I do want to put the fact that natural gas is a fossil fuel, is a substantial U.S. resource. In fact, with the gas shale plays in the U.S. and the other natural gas sources in the U.S., the United States will be self-sufficient in natural gas and have enough resources for the next 100 to 150 years. So I think that if that fuel provides the low carbon benefits that you desire and most people in this country desire and world desires, and we can do it at prices that knock the socks off the prices of diesel and gasoline, I think that the low carbon fuel standard is going to be a trigger mechanism to help make that happen. And like I say, I kind of feel at a disadvantage following an economist and not being able to view the slides, but I think I understand the upside down arrows versus the right side up arrows, and I think that natural gas, as it applies and complies with the low carbon fuel standard in Oregon, I think will be a very beneficial fuel for the state of Oregon. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be glad to answer any questions later.
Thank you, Mr. Edens. We're going to hold questions except for this one. Just say a brief word about clean energy fuels.
Clean energy fuels is the largest natural gas fuel provider in North America. We have more than 240 stations spread over the U.S. We're in 24 states in the United States, and a couple of, and also we have offshore operations through some of our subsidiaries in Southeast Asia, India, Europe, South America. We have fueling stations in Peru. We fuel on a daily basis more than 20,000 fleet vehicles. We're on target to sell more than 150 million gallons of natural gas fuel into the transportation market. We also have a significant new renewable natural gas subsidiary that was formed several weeks ago that is focusing near term on landfill gas operations to take that renewable natural gas fuel out of that and clean it up and put it into pipelines so that we can sell it as a low carbon transportation fuel.
Good. That helps me a lot, and we'll just leave it at that, but hold on for questions. And Mr. Beard, are you in the room? Please come forward, but I'll ask Mr. Hill to go right ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Ian Hill, and I am CEO, co-founder of Sequential Biofuels. I also served on the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Committee, along with some of the other individuals who've heard testify today, and also learned quite a bit through that process and came away very impressed with DEQ and the rigor with which they're undertaking this effort. So a little bit about our company. Our company is an Oregon-grown company. We're Oregon's only vertically integrated biofuel company. We operate a biodiesel production facility here in Salem that produces approximately 6 million gallons a year right now, with an ultimate capacity as built of 17 million gallons. Our family of companies has grown from three individuals as University of Oregon students down in Eugene, three of us, to over 85 at this point. And we continue to see ample opportunity to grow here in Oregon. Of note, the biodiesel that we produce in Salem, according to CARB and EPA calculations, is the least carbon-intensive liquid fuel available in the market here in Oregon and in the U.S., and not that ours is lower carbon than any other fuel, but the nature of our fuel makes it the least carbon-intensive liquid fuel available in the market. And additionally, our fuel today, our pure biodiesel product, our neat product, is priced cheaper at the retail pump than its counterpart petroleum diesel. And then if you compare the cost of our fuel with gasoline and you look at the greater mileage benefit of diesel vehicles compared to gasoline vehicles, our fuel today, and again, it's the least carbon-intensive fuel available on the market. I believe the number, according to CARB and EPA, is something around 89% less carbon-intensive than petroleum diesel, is 30 to 60% cheaper or less expensive than gasoline. And that's today. That's right now. One of our fleet customers that's been a customer for quite some time is operating their entire Oregon-based fleet on B99.9. We have 0.1% of petroleum in there. We need to subsidize them. They are saving money doing so, operating their entire fleet on B99. And again, that's happening today, right now. A couple things I want to bring up that I think were omitted with the earlier testimony, and that's that we already have one of our country's premier cellulosic technology developers building a pilot plant here in Oregon, out in eastern Oregon, in Boardman, and we look forward to seeing that company develop and grow. Our company retails ethanol produced by a company here in Cornelius, Oregon, that is a food processor ultimately, but is using their waste stream to produce very low-carbon ethanol fuel. Again, that's happening today in Oregon right now. And then, you know, a lot of what we've heard about as far as the cons or the potential negatives of this policy are, you know, what bad can happen. Well, I'd like to look just a little bit at Oregon's renewable fuel policies to date and what's happened. Right now, since April 1st, we're operating with a B5 or 5% biodiesel renewable fuel standard. And again, our B99 is cheaper than petroleum diesel at the retail pump. And then to back up some of the positive impacts of this sort of legislation or policy, I would take just a couple points that I pulled off the Oregon Department of Agriculture's website, and I've included a reference at the end of my testimony for that that you can look for yourself. In 2010, the U.S. spent $28 billion a month on foreign oil. That is a massive transfer of wealth during a period of great economic hardship. This year, in January of 2011, traditionally one of the lowest demand months of the year for fuel, when fuel should be the cheapest, we actually spent $35 billion on that same product. America spends $137 billion annually defending Persian Gulf oil, adding more than a dollar per gallon to gas prices. A new study conducted by economists at Iowa State University and the University of Wisconsin and released by the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development found that the increased use of ethanol reduced wholesale gasoline prices by an average of 89 cents per gallon in 2010. The new analysis also found that the growth in ethanol production has reduced gasoline prices by an average of 25 cents or 16% over the entire decade of 2000 to 2010. Further, the study determined that gas prices should double if ethanol production came to an immediate halt. The study is available for the at the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development website. Another study that I like to reference is a 2008 National Renewable Energy Laboratory study that found that ethanol in the fuel supply reduced retail gasoline prices by an average of 17 cents. That study took into account the lower mileage impact of ethanol. And again, you can look at these studies yourself by following the reference link included. So I would like to conclude my testimony by simply saying that the biofuel industry in Oregon is producing lower carbon fuel right now, today, and we see great opportunity to continue to do so and grow jobs, grow family wage jobs, and to lower the carbon emissions of the fuel coming out of our tailpipes and increase the positive impacts if we continue to give ample opportunity and support by wise policies such as this. So we strongly endorse and continue to support the low carbon fuel standard. My only one issue with it is that I would love to see the sunset pulled out of there. The sunset really does nothing for us except provide a wet blanket for our investors, our shareholders, to continue to invest in Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please.
Co-Chairman Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon and members of the committee. I'm George Beard. I'm here from Portland State University. And I would like to ask you before I give you my unprepared remarks, brief though they'll be, how is your time here? Do you have, are you under severe time pressure?
I'm going to lose my co-chair in 6 minutes.
Okay. So I'm
gonna, happy to stay.
All right. Well, I'm going to try and give you just two or three general statements that could be useful to the discussion. I'm attached to Portland State University's Office of Research and Strategic Partnerships, and at the moment a lot of my work has to do with electric vehicles. I've been working in that domain for the last two or three years. My comments are probably less about the low-carbon fuel standard and more about the importance of the context and the rationale that gives to the activities of people who are involved in Oregon's clean transportation, sustainable mobility movement, because it really does. I think there are probably two or three principles that guide the people who are involved in that. One of them is that obviously, we have a problem with oil. I don't need to recount that to you. And if you travel, you know, we've had 30 years to work on this problem, and we're worse off today than we were 30 years ago. And as each year passes, we grow weaker and more vulnerable. So you know that, and I know that. It seems to me, and I'm not in your difficult and important position of making policy and setting laws, but it seems to me that you either pursue a strategy and adopt a portfolio of choices and bets on the future, because any way you cut it, we're going to have to move as a society. People have to move, freight has to move, and if we don't take a position, then we continue to default to what we have grown so accustomed to, which is petroleum-based mobility. We've come to love that habit for 100 years, but it's not one that we can live with if we follow our instincts and the best data that are available to us. So now the question probably is, to what extent does Oregon as a special place have an obligation to pursue a portfolio of choices over time, because none of us know exactly what will take hold, what will be successful, and so forth. We do have several advantages, though. We have a quirky and innovative citizenry that has shown itself over time to be responsive. We have a whole scattering of industry and entrepreneurship here that is beginning to take hold. You just heard this story today. I was talking to Mark Frohnmeyer from Arcimoto.
I can tell you, as I drove by Wilsonville today, there's one of the first DC fast charging plants from Eaton that's right here in Oregon. So there's, you know, if we try and judge this in the early days, in stage one or stage two of the innovation, we might come up short and say, well, this isn't going to work. This isn't supplanting it. This isn't at the pace and depth and acceleration that we hope for. But my appeal to you is this. I've been here, and I was living in Portland when we began another important innovation. We sometimes don't think of it quite this way, but the movement into light rail trains up in Portland, the movement into the electrification of transportation began about 30 years ago, and it was met with a robust public debate and with a lot of doubters who said, this won't succeed, people won't follow this, it's cheaper to move people by buses and to use number two diesel fuel, and we still do that today, to be sure. But 30 years later, and that's what the adoption curve has been, 30 years later, we can report that that's how a lot of people roll in Portland, and because of it, it means that there's literally tens of thousands of vehicle trips, combustion engine vehicle trips, that are not taken. And it was good enough to beget streetcars, and it was good enough so that we now build those for other places. I tell you that because the story here, I think, is one that has to be judged over time and not in a single moment in time. The terrible anxiety you have is in this single moment in time, you have to make real hard decisions about money and jobs and everything else. But this much I am certain. We cannot continue to move people in the way that we have for the last 100 years, and we cannot dally as we have in the last 30 years, or the next 30 years aren't going to be very appealing for any of us. And for that reason, I appeal to you to let this legislation stand and to manage the portfolio of approaches and the innovation that will occur under the radar and above the radar to see how this works. I don't have your terrible and difficult job, but it just seems to me strategically that's the choice that you've got. If you can preserve this, the dividends will be born in ways that none of us understand, but we may very well appreciate downstream. Thanks for your comments.
Thank you for those comments, and we'll have questions. I would note from what you said, Mr. Beard, the reference to quirky and innovative, that is a moniker that people have applied to my co-chair and myself.
And it's you, met with high regard.
I'll leave you to say which one is which. colleagues, do you have any questions for Mr. Eaves on the phone or other guests here in front of you? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just the concept of the subsidies has been interesting throughout this afternoon, and the subsidies either for our oil companies or for that which we're now currently engaged in, whether it's electric or whether it's sequential fuels. And it wouldn't be fair if I allowed either of you to escape without asking that question. So is there some place that we can look and see what type of public input we've had into these various alternative arrangements so we can go online and say, okay, this is why whatever it is that we're now buying is whatever price it might be. Because it gets really confusing if we don't have some sort of a standard across the board understanding of the public input. The subsidy is what I'm getting at. And that applies to electric cars first. I'd like to hear about from sequential fuels first.
Okay, well, I guess I would ask for a clarification of the question. I'm not sure I'm...
Representative Benz.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, well, the question is this. For each gallon of fuel that Sequential produces, how much has the public invested in it? Whether it be by a tax credit, whether it be by you name it. And the question was asked earlier by Representative Bailey about the oil companies, and it's a good question. And mm-hmm. It seems to me we need to eventually establish this kind of public input cost. So I'm just asking, this low carbon fuel standard is another means of public input. Mm-hmm. What are we already doing?
Well, on a per gallon basis, I would be challenged to give you a figure, and I apologize for that. I can say this. Well, I can give you a list of the different policy subsidies that exist today for biofuels, but maybe I'll preface that by this tale, and it's a tale of last year for our industry. Our industry has lived since 2004 with a federal incentive that incentivizes on a per gallon basis the production of biodiesel. That incentive last year, even though it's done for a year cycle and then renewed annually, we didn't have that incentive renewed until the end of the year last year. And so our industry kind of fell apart to some degree with that unexpected removal and then very belatedly giving back of the subsidy. But our company, by the end of that year, we actually saw that as a really healthy process that made us a much stronger company. And at this point, we're anticipating that at the end of this year, that particular subsidy goes away forever and we don't need it anymore. We used it to grow and now we're off of it. And we're done with it, and we're ready to compete without that particular subsidy. So I would say that we don't at all expect or look at any of these policies as long-term handouts to our industry, but just as a way to level the playing field and get us to a starting position to be able to compete.
Just follow up, Mr.
Quick follow-up, and we'll have Representative Witt.
Thank you. The concern I have is that the bio element of any diesel fuel or anything else has its own subsidy. So if you're acquiring that bio element from some other place, we have it available because of another subsidy. Mm-hmm. So for us to understand that these costs is a complex and very necessary matter. So I'm not sufficiently familiar with your operation to know whether you're buying your bio element from someplace else or buy your bio component. But if you are, that is being subsidized. And so I need at some point we'll need to see this entire chart of public input. And if you know where that is or where I can find it, I'd much appreciate it. Because it's that kind of measurement, that kind of criteria, that kind of standard is hugely important to us.
Absolutely, and agreed. And I can certainly supply you with references that would be able to give you that detail of information. And I would just put forward that the bio component of what we sell is entirely that bio component, and it is all produced here in Oregon and largely from feedstocks that are sourced here in Oregon. So those jobs are very much local Oregon and Northwest jobs that are being used to produce that bio element.
And we would welcome that offline. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ian, compliments to you for your entrepreneurial spirit and for helping to grow a new industry here in Oregon. Could you tell us what percent of roughly biodiesel that's sold in Oregon is Sequential's fuel?
Well, let's see. Chairman Witt, and my apologies to Chairman Bentz for not properly addressing you. I'm new at this.
You're doing fine.
Thank you. The 6 million gallons a year that we produce, the rate at which we produce that right now, the preponderance of that fuel is sold in Oregon.
Okay.
The renewable fuel standard creates a market that is larger than that. So I would I'd hazard to guess that roughly 30% of the renewable fuel standard by total volume in Oregon is supplied by our production facility. That's a rough number.
Thank you. And so presumably the percentage of all diesel sold in Oregon is smaller yet. And you probably don't have, do you have any idea what percentage of all diesel sold in Oregon? That's probably a question that you may not have a grasp at.
What percentage of diesel?
Yes, sold in Oregon would be sequential diesel.
Diesel fuel that's blended with biodiesel to make a...
I hadn't actually anticipated that portion of it, but I guess that would be a component of my question as well, yes.
Well, sir, we're largely a producer and then wholesaler, and in only a couple instances do we actually retail fuel ourselves. So largely what we're selling is that neat product. So, again, it's roughly at the rate of 6 million gallons a year right now.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes. Please do.
Do you anticipate any significant increases say in 2015 and then again perhaps by 2025 in terms of your production and or sales?
Yes, absolutely. Right now we're in the process of developing or further augmenting the current technology that we use that will allow us to access another feedstock stream that is available in the Northwest. So we do anticipate growth for our production facility, our capacity here in Oregon.
Anything further? A comment, Mr. Please. Chairman? I think that this underscores a point that our first panel was trying to make, that the costs of our alternative fuels infrastructure has not necessarily been factored into our considerations for the low carbon fuel standard, and despite the very best efforts of the leading biodiesel producer in the state of Oregon, it is still a relatively low amount of fuel, and one would expect that if, as the testimony was earlier, it is 30% cheaper than standard biodiesel, that they would have cornered the market as yet. But it is a significant challenge that this company and other similarly situated companies face. And as a result, this may have a very great impact ultimately on the pricing, as was pointed out by our first panel. And I think that's something that we need to take into consideration.
Thank you for that comment. Mr. Co-Chair, I know you have
Mr.
to...
Mr. Chairman, can I speak to that issue? This is Mike Eaves.
Yeah, just a hold on a minute, folks. You need to go. Then, okay, good.
I'll
tell
my
you
apologies.
About the end of it.
Yes.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yes, from a clean energy perspective, the question on infrastructure is a great question. The price differential that I gave you for gasoline and diesel, those are the prices with clean energy putting in all the capital to build the infrastructure and earning a rate of return, earning its appropriate rate of return, in addition to supplying those types of cost savings benefits onto the customer. So we have capital recovery, desired capital recovery already embedded in that price at the pump and still generating $1.50 to $2 savings.
Thank you for that clarification. I think that's all the questions we have or have time for this panel. And I did want to get back to the director if he'd come up. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I know you weren't planning on this, but you always are a good sport, Director Peterson. And I'm interested in any brief comments you have, but as you know, I'm specifically interested in that conversation or that insight into what the department's view on our calendar on this subject.
Sure. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Department of Environmental Quality. I will start out by thanking you for having this informational item, and certainly thank the panelists that were here. As you heard, most of them, or a lot of them, participated on our advisory committee when we pulled together the information, and I certainly appreciate all of their efforts. And as you can tell, it's a complicated topic, and I think you heard that everybody appreciated what we did in terms of learning a lot and teeing up a lot of questions. So I do believe a lot of that carried forth. Now, what I wanted to say specifically is that in addition to the 2009, what the 2009 legislation did was not only ask us to put together a robust advisory committee, it asked us to really get a much broader review or input into a low-carbon fuel standard. And so that's built into the 2009 legislature. So we finished the advisory committee process. Now what we're doing is starting to reach out beyond the advisory committee with groups and public and others to get feedback not only on different views of what we're doing, but also to take into account other new information before we make a decision in terms of moving forward with a low-carbon fuel standard. And I, too, would appreciate the Dr. Pozdina's information analysis to get it to the department so we can take a look at that. That would be great.
That we share that as well.
And so we anticipate spending the rest of, or the balance of this year, reaching out and getting more information as it relates to the low-carbon fuel standards. At the end of this calendar year, if we decide to move forward, we would initiate rulemaking in the first half of 2012. And just so you understand, 2012 would only be a record-keeping year that would be required in terms of rulemaking. And then during that time, we'd also provide technical assistance to get ready for a reporting year, which would be 2013, and a low-carbon fuel standard would be implemented in 2014. Now, another thing that the legislature did in 2009 was put in a sunset date, and that is December 31st of 2015. And it also required that we report to all legislative assemblies in terms of the progress that we're making. We do anticipate coming to the 2013 legislative session to report on our rulemaking if we carry forward with it and get not only feedback, but we're going to need resources to implement a low-carbon fuel standard. And at that time, we're going to have to address the sunset date, because it will not make sense, as I think you heard earlier, to move forward with a low-carbon fuel standard that will sunset in a short period of time. So we do anticipate, prior to a low-carbon fuel standard actually being implemented, if we follow this, coming to the legislature to not only get resources to implement, but to deal with the sunset date that's in the statute currently. So that's the path. I think there's a lot of checks and balances, checkpoints that has been developed here, rightfully so. I think this is something that there's a lot of great interest in. We know that, and we're committed to do what the legislature told us to do, which was not only develop something that was robust, but get the as much input as we possibly can into this standard.
Thank you for that insight, and thank you for sticking with us not only today but also through this process. You're accessible, and you've got great information, and we appreciate that kind of communication very, very much. Do you have a question for the director? I think Representative Benz might.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The cost, if we don't get this right, it's pretty enormous, depending, looking at the two different studies that you're faced with, just diametrically opposed. So I can sure understand the care that you're taking. I much appreciate it. I can't think of anything more dangerous to the economy if the economist we heard earlier is correct, or anything more helpful if the other is. And so seeing that you're right in the middle, I really appreciate the time and care you're taking, because it's really challenging to the state either way.
Thank you. Well, with that, we're going to close this hearing. Thank you, Director Peterson, for joining us here at the end. Often when I chair, I wear my committee down to this, and I want to just say how special Representative Witt and Benz are. I would say one quick comment about this. My co-chair and I, and when he's not here, I feel free to talk about him, see this issue very differently. But you know, I appreciate very much his willingness to have this hearing and to ask the questions that he asked, and to continue to focus on this. Somebody said in the testimony, Oregon's a special place. Everybody in this room, I think, would agree with that. I guess for me, the question on this subject is, you know, how hard do we want to push on regulation, and hopefully not, but I fear, hurt existing business, existing infrastructure, existing jobs, in order to reach a goal that I think we all share. I am not going to give my hydrogen speech, so nobody get excited. But the reason I'm excited about hydrogen is because, regardless of whether you want to, you know, argue the policy of the United States of America in the Persian Gulf, or whether you just would like to see more jobs in Oregon, we need to rally around renewables. But in the meantime, we're all going to drive those cars, and we're all going to want that freight moved. Things got to change. Things will change. But how we inject ourselves into that change and cause the least amount of harm, I think, is extremely important. I have a daughter at Portland State. I would have said this if Professor Beard had stayed. It's a fabulous system that she uses. Max and the streetcars are great. I'm a Blazer fan and a basketball nut. When I go to the Blazer games, I love to park on the outlying areas and take Max in. It's a fabulous system. However, I don't anticipate in my district very soon a stop between Mount Angel and Silverton. And the last thing I'd say about that is I'm an old Hatfield guy. I was on the Hatfield staff, and there's his point was well taken, so I'm not just pushing back, but I would say politically, the fact we have all the TriMet, the TriMet, the Max, and so forth, has a lot to do with the fact that the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the United States Senate was from Oregon, and the secretary of the Department of Transportation was former Mayor Goldschmidt from Oregon. That's not a coincidence that a ton of money was poured in to make that possible. Will it pay off in the future? You know, I sure hope so. But the upfront costs, how we fund these things, are very important. I think we had a good discussion today. I appreciate both panels, and I appreciate the director being here. I appreciate your questions. So thank you all. With that, I will close this informational hearing on the low-carbon fuel standard and adjourn the committee, the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.
Mr. Chair, the reason the two of us stayed is because